So this is an unusual day. You remember when you enjoyed the 2 days off individually for the two holidays, since you're a Monday section? Well, now you have to pay for it because you're 2 days behind, which means I need to finish up the unit in here for Monday's test. I know I've taught this enough times that I realize that today's normal lab and the next lab next week, microscopes today, cells next week, could really be done in 1 day. And if that's what ends up happening, that's fine. So if I have to use the entire period to get through the lectures, I will. We'll get through the labs. Don't worry about that. But I want to make sure, I don't want to go through the quiz because I want to make sure I have enough time to get through these remaining slides. So this is lecture material, you understand that, right, even though we're in the lab. Okay, well, we stopped at slide 13, and 13 really just, not really any new information. It just shows you not only that vesicles get transported from the rough ER to the cis space, or the receiving end of the Golgi, deliver their contents, Golgi figures out where they need to go, then repackages it into vesicles that either go somewhere else inside the cell, or get fused with the plasma membrane and either spill out the contents, or if they happen to be embedded in the membrane, they'll become part of the plasma membrane itself. Okay, so it's just a picture illustrating what I've already described in words. 14 also doesn't really have any new information except for me to a little bit more carefully describe the anatomy of the mitochondria. And I already told you that it is a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. So there are two membranes, and they are called descriptively the outer membrane and the inner membrane. Notice, though, that the outer membrane is actually smaller than the inner membrane in terms of the amount of surface area. The outer membrane is basically just as big as it needs to be to enclose the whole thing. The inner membrane, though, has a lot more surface area because it folds back and forth many times. And it does that to increase the surface area, just like microvilli do the same thing. And that's because the thing that the mitochondrion does, which remember is cellular respiration, involves a lot of proteins embedded in membrane, and the more membrane you have, the more efficiently it can do that job. So since there are two membranes in a mitochondrion, that means that there are two compartments within the mitochondrion itself. There is the space between the two membranes, which is called the intermembrane space. That's one fluid. And then there's also the compartment that's fully inside the inner membrane. And that stuff collectively is called the mitochondrial matrix. So the matrix is one fluid compartment, the intermembrane space is another, and they are chemically different from each other, separated by that inner membrane. But we'll talk about what happens in there in its own chapter, in its own unit. Oh, except that anatomically I should tell you that these folds that the inner membrane has are called cristae, that's the plural, of crista. One fold is a crista. 15 is a close-up of the chloroplast. It's also multiply membrane-bounded. Now, technically, there are two membranes, just like there are for a mitochondrion, but they get three different names because the inner membrane is even more highly elaborated or folded than for the mitochondrion. So there's the outer membrane, there is the inner membrane, and then there is what's called the thylakoid membrane. But the thylakoid membrane really is just an extension. It's the elaborate folding of the inner membrane, okay? The thylakoid membrane is named for the fact that those folds, which are in the shape of these coin-looking things, each one of those individual coin-shaped things is called a thylakoid. All right? And notice that they're stacked. It's all one membrane, as you can see in cross-section, but it goes back and forth many times to form what look like stacks of coins. One coin is a thylakoid, one stack is a granum, which is the singular, but there are several grana, which is the plural, within one chloroplast, all made out of thylakoid membrane. And therefore, there's three fluids that we name. There is the intermembrane space, just like for the mitochondria, in between the outer and inner membrane. There is the fluid that is outside of the thylakoids, but inside the inner membrane, and that's called the stroma. And then there's the fluid that's inside the thylakoids, which is called the thylakoid space. What happens in each of those, we'll talk about in the photosynthesis chapter. Sixteen is just a real photograph rather than a cartoon. You can see that the this idea of stacked coins is not really just a cartoon figment of someone's imagination. They really are stacked, as you see here. But that's all one elaborate membrane. Then we get to the cytoskeleton in slide 17. I already told you earlier that there are three major categories of fibrous proteins making up the cytoskeleton, which are the microtubules, the intermediate filaments, and the microfilaments. We see two of those here. Microtubules are called that, meaning small tubule, obviously, for a good reason. They are the proteins that make them up are arranged in such a way that each microtubule is hollow. So it actually is like a tube, not a rod. The filaments, on the other hand, are like rods, and they're smaller diameters. The intermediate filaments, by the way, are called that because they are intermediate in diameter between the smallest ones, which are the microfilaments, and the largest ones, which are the microtubules. In 18, we can see the microtubule here being used for what I said it is used for earlier today in the other recording, which is that it serves as a system of roadways. So what is happening in cartoon form is really what has happening. It's not just a cartoon. There are proteins called motor proteins, the thing in red in cartoon, that have two legs, two actual legs, that walk along a microtubule one step at a time, connecting to the microtubule temporarily, and then disconnecting the other leg and moving it up and connecting it again one step at a time. Each step requires energy. That's why ATP is being spent here. So it takes many steps to get this package, which is a vesicle that the motor protein is hauling, just like what's in the back of a semi, basically, walking it one step at a time along a microtubule from one place in the cell to another place in the cell. And you see the real version below. The microtubule is being walked on by those vesicles that are being carried by motor proteins. Yeah.
Do we know how long it takes to get to?
Someone does, because some cytologists have I'm sure measured that, but I don't have an answer. Okay. I could give you a number, but it would just be a total guess.
I can imagine.
And I'm sure it depends also. It probably depends on cell type and species. Okay, 19. I'm not going to read every little bit of information or hold you to it. I just want to show you what I've already told you, that the microtubules are the widest in diameter, and they are hollow. The microfilaments are the narrowest in diameter, and they are important structurally, like little ropes, but they're also really important in moving things. So microfilaments are actually specialized microfilaments in your skeletal muscles are why your skeletal muscles can shorten or contract to move your skeleton around, to let you have motions. But it also, this can happen within a cell. An individual cell can just distort itself because of microfilament interactions. And then the intermediate filaments, those really are more like ropes than anything else. They're intermediate in diameter between the small and the large ones, and they hold things in place. They have high tensile strength, so they resist being stretched, just like real ropes. Yeah.
Now the middle one is you said it was easier to move stuff across that one.
No, stuff doesn't move across it. That happens on microtubules. The actin microfilaments are what allow other filaments to move across them, increasing their overlap. And so they don't, the filaments themselves don't shorten in your muscles. Your whole muscle shortens because two different kinds of microfilaments move past each other and overlap more. And the more they overlap, the shorter the cell gets, even without the filaments getting shorter themselves. Okay, let's go to 20. Once again, you have this not very well-defined centrosome. It's just the yellow halo region. That's the microtubule organizing center, which is important for mitosis, part of cell division. And plant cells have them, remember. Other fungi are also eukaryotes, so they undergo mitosis. They have them as well. But animals, unlike the other ones, animals have centrioles in their centrosomes. Those are the things that look like the licorice and that I said we don't really know what they're for yet. So if you see centrioles, you're looking at an animal cell specifically. Plant would have the centrosome, but no licorice in it. Okay, 21. Some cells are flagellated. As we said, sperm is a good example for humans. But if a cell is flagellated, if it has a flagellum or multiple flagella, then they are used for locomotion, which means to get from point A to point B, to travel through the medium that the cell is living in, whatever fluid that is. And it does that just like the propeller of a boat. It pushes on the fluid and therefore propels the cell through it. They're usually quite long, and usually they'll be on just one end of a cell because it's going to be moved in one direction, just like you only have one propeller in the back of a normal boat. Cilia, on the other hand, are different kind of appendages. Cilium, the singular, means hair. It's not actually hair, but they look like tiny hairs on the cell. They're also involved in movement, but they're a little bit different. First of all, they're much shorter than flagella. Cells might have cilia, they might have flagella, or they might have neither. But if it's cilia, they are much smaller, shorter than flagella. And also, if a cell is ciliated, it usually will be ciliated over a large surface, if not the entire surface of the cell, not just on one end like a flagellum. But if there are flagella, they will beat back and forth in synchrony. And therefore, they're kind of like little oars that push on the water, right? So if it is a free-living cell on its own, then the beating of the cilia can make it tumble through the fluid and move it from point A to point B. But you also can have a cell that's part of a multicellular organism like you are, where that cell is not free-living, it's held in place as part of the body. And in that case, the beating of the cilia is not about moving the cell through the medium. It's about moving the medium past the cell. A good example is the epithelial cells that line your airway, line the trachea. They are not only ciliated, but they are also mucus, which means they produce mucus, which is thick, sticky stuff, right? When you inhale air, the only thing you really want to get to your lungs is oxygen, but it's just one component of the air, right? You have to take in everything in that mixture, which can include a bunch of solid debris, like soot and other pollutants, but also organisms that could harm you, like bacteria that are in the air. Well, they stick pretty nicely to the mucus, keeping them from going into the delicate alveoli of the lungs. So that holds them into place, which solves part of the problem. But then the continuous beating of the cilia actually moves that whole slimy mucoid surface that contains these things stuck to it upward to your throat, out of the trachea, into your pharynx, which is your throat, where you swallow it continuously, which is a perfect thing to do for things that could harm you, because putting that into your stomach means exposing those things to the most inhospitable part of your body because of the low pH, the very high acidity of your stomach will kill most things. So it's like putting it in the trash, basically, safely. 22. Here we're looking at the molecular structure of just a single cilium, just one of these cilia. And I said that they beat back and forth. This shows you kind of how they do this. When you're really close up, you can see that each cilium is made up of many fibrous proteins, these yellow ones, and then other proteins as well, these red ones, which are motor proteins, just like the ones that walk along microtubules. Well, these are microtubules as well, but they're specialized for a cilium. And these motor proteins are not about moving things from one place in the cell to another. The motor proteins are connected to one microtubule on this end, right? And then they walk along another microtubule where the two legs are. So when they're all walking, that means they're trying to walk this microtubule so it slides against the other microtubule. You see that? Now, if that were all that were in place, it would just make one microtubule go slide past the other one. But it's not the only proteins involved. You also have these blue ones, which are proteins anchoring the motor proteins so that they can't slip past each other very much. Now, I can do this by analogy with two pieces of paper. If these are two microtubules that aren't anchored together, but you have motor proteins between them walking one against the other, they would just do this, right? Notice that the whole thing doesn't bend. It just gets longer. But if you have the two microtubules anchored together, which I can do with a fold, right? This is, now they're held together, but I still have those microtubules walking one along the other, then it will bend in one direction or the other, right? Depending on which way you walk. So that's what happens at a molecular level in these cilia. They're all moving back and forth because of these motor proteins at the expense of ATP, walking along other microtubules, bending the cilia. Well, what I just bothered to tell you in vocal form is shown in cartoon form in slide 23. I always forget that there's already a picture. I wouldn't have to do that with the paper, but hopefully this explains what I just said. If they weren't anchored together by those third proteins, they would just slip past each other. But since they are anchored, it will bend. Now in 24, we can see these microvilli that we talked about earlier. They're not only made of plasma membrane. That's their main use, right? To increase the amount of plasma membrane and therefore increase the surface area without actually increasing the volume. But inside the microvillus, each microvillus individually, are portions of the cytoskeleton, microfilaments that give it, you know, the microvillus would otherwise just not really have any ability to keep its shape. The microfilaments inside it keep its shape. You can also see intermediate filaments in this one, which make up a lot of the overall cytoskeleton in the cytoplasm. But notice that the microfilaments are anchored to the intermediate filaments of the rest of the cytoskeleton. It's all tied together with kind of like spot welds. 25. At the top of this, we can see what I was describing earlier when I mentioned microfilaments being involved in shortening your muscles. This is how, when you get really close up within one muscle cell, this is how they're arranged molecularly. You have myosin microfilaments and actin microfilaments, the purple and the orange ones, and at the expense of ATP, they can be moved past each other, kind of like what's happening in the cilia, but using a different molecules to do that. Neither one of them gets shorter themselves. Just like, you know, if my two hands represent one piece of the length of a muscle cell, my fingers represent myosin and actin filaments, and if I increase their overlap, my thumbs get closer together, even though I haven't shortened any of my fingers, right? That's what's happening inside a muscle cell, and that's why they get shorter. That's the only thing that a muscle can do actively on its own, is to get shorter. They can only pull, they never push. So that's one use of those actin microfilaments. But they're also just used, like I said, to distort the shape of the cell. For instance, in an amoeboid cell, amoeboid means that it's continuously changing its shape. So you look at it one moment, it'll have a totally different shape the next, because it's with the use of these actin microfilaments, the shape of the overall cytoskeleton is continuously changing, and this is one way it's able to walk around, basically, by pseudopodal locomotion. Pseudopod means false foot, because it's not always there. It's only there for a while, then it changes shape. And the similar thing is what's called cytoplasmic streaming that you will probably see next week, or you might be able to see when you look at plant cells under the scopes. Especially because in a light microscope, you're shining light from one side, right? And plants want their chloroplast to be where the light is, because that's the light is what powers photosynthesis. So by using these microfilaments, that plants can move their organelles around, including the chloroplasts, and get them on the sunny side of the leaf. So it's a lot more efficient. It's 26 doesn't have any new information in it either. We've already talked about plasmodesmata. It's just a closer up view. In fact, it's not even as good a view, because in the other one, it gave you a better sense of what I was telling you, that the plasma membrane doesn't really have a hole in it. The plasma membrane wraps from one cell through the tunnel to the other cell. It's all continuous. But the plasmodesma does perforate through the cell wall. And that's the only kind of plant intercellular junction we'll talk about, but there are going to be three that we'll talk about in animals. 27 first, though, here we have a piece of plasma membrane, the extracellular fluid outside the cell, intracellular fluid inside. You can see a couple things here. One is that often, especially in multicellular organisms, outside of the cell, you have a matrix. It can be a pretty rich matrix of all kinds of different things, including proteins and other macromolecules. It's collectively called the extracellular matrix. But where does this stuff come from, these proteins and these other things? Same place all proteins come from, which is where? Where do cells come? I mean, where do proteins come from? Don't overthink this. Yeah. From cells, yes. Proteins don't just pop into existence. They have to be built by cells using instructions in genes, right? So even though this stuff ends up outside the cell, it has to be manufactured either inside the cell or at the surface and then exported as it goes. It then assembles outside. But it can be proteins, and that's what the purple things represent, or it can be other macromolecules, including often polysaccharides or even smaller carbohydrates. And then sometimes it's a mixture of the two. For instance, if you have a protein with a sugar connected to it, carbohydrate, a sugar is a carbohydrate, right? Then you have a glycoprotein. Glyco means sugar. It's partly carbohydrate, partly protein. And actually, you see this often in multicellular organisms like your own body, because the sugar part, the protein holds it in the membrane, the sugar part that hangs outside, hangs off of the protein, serves as a little ID badge. In a multicellular organism like your body, it's important for the cells of your body to recognize all the other cells of your body as you and not as a potential invader. So these sugars act like little ID tags saying, don't kill me, I'm one of you. But if they don't have that ID tag, then they can be killed. Another thing we see here, though, is that proteins that are membrane-bound, part of the membrane itself, would easily be pulled out, right? If some external force pulled on them. So they are anchored to proteins making up the cytoskeleton, keeping them in place without, and it's also tension relief for the phospholipid bilayer. Because by being connected here, you tug on them, you're not going to disrupt this phospholipid bilayer nearly as much as you would if they weren't connected. Yeah?
Is that why there's like a little chunk on the bottom of the...
That's just a different subunit of the same protein. So it could be a different polypeptide of a quaternary protein, one of these ones that are multimeric.
But it's just anchored to microglobulin.
Correct. Whoops. 28, also no new information. You just see real pictures of plasmodesmata. These are just like the cartoons, though, to show you that they really do exist. But let's now talk about animal intercellular junctions. Plasmodesmata are in plants. In animals, we'll talk about three different kinds, and they're all shown on slide 29. First of all, the one in the middle box right here is called a desmosome. And look at the cartoon here. This is a cutaway view of a cell. You're looking at the interior of one cell right here. And then this is the next cell and the other cell on the other side. Desmosomes are intercellular junctions that are complexes of protein arranged closely together and acting like little spot welds. Like if you have two pieces of sheet metal, this is the way car bodies are made. They're not welded together over the entire surface. They're just spot welded here and there, holding the two sheets together. That's what's happening with animal cells that are next to each other. They're held in place so they don't move around by these desmosomes. So there can be several desmosomes, but each one is like a little spot weld. Now, a similar thing, what is similar about gap junctions, shown below it, is that they are also complexes of proteins. These intercellular junctions are just complexes of proteins. But they're not similar in their function. Desmosomes are about mechanical integrity, holding them together, structural integrity. Gap junctions are not about holding the cells together. They're about forming little tunnels. So gap junctions are the animal versions of what we call plasmodesmata in plants. And that, not all cells in an animal have gap junctions, but some do. A good example is your heart. The cells of your heart have gap junctions that allow for electrical signals in the form of ions to flow between cells, from one cell to another, which allows all the cells in the atria to contract at the same time, which is important for it to act as a pump, right? You wouldn't want them contracting at different times. So all the atria contract, all the cells of the ventricles then contract to pump it out of the other chambers. Did you have a question?
An example of that gap junction would be like a freeway junction along two different freeways.
Yeah, it would be like a road between two towns. The towns would be the cells. Now, the third one is more complex in terms of structure. It's called a tight junction. It's all of this purple stuff. And we're looking, remember, at only one half of this cell. If we didn't remove the front, this would wrap all the way around. And so it's like double-sided tape, really. If you have a collection of cells, and each one had double-sided tape around it, that the other side of that tape would stick it to the other cells. But tight junctions are not really just about holding them together, because that's the job of the desmosomes. Instead, the tight junctions, by being like a band of tape all the way around it, prevent things from slipping through the spaces between cells. So up to now, in the term, I've been using the word membrane a lot. I've been using the microscopic version of the word. like a plasma membrane, right? Invisible, invisibly small. It's molecules. It's smaller than a cell, right? Or the membrane of a mitochondrion or any of the other mentions I've said of membrane. It's all been microscopic. But there's also the macroscopic use of the word, multicellular membranes, like your skin, for instance. The epidermis is a membrane, but it's made of millions of cells, so it's much bigger, right? Well, if you have a multicellular membrane made of however many layers of cells, and you are a particle, whatever particle, doesn't matter, that wants to get through that membrane, then you have two possible routes you could travel by. You could take what's called the cellular route, which means you actually enter a cell by going through its plasma membrane, then travel through the distance and go through the other side of it and into the next cell and so on. That's the cellular route. Or you could take what's called the paracellular route, which is just simply go between the cells. Well, certain things can't get through the plasma membrane. So the cellular route can be blocked for that reason, which means those things would have to take the paracellular route. Well, a tight junction is in place to block that paracellular junction also. So that means only things that the cell will let into itself will be allowed to get through this multicellular membrane. And this is why, for instance, the skin is such a good barrier, because it has tight junctions around its cells. Okay? But that's why it's like tape, so that it forms a seal all the way around it. Yeah.
But if it's allowed in the cell, why wouldn't it take the cell route?
Well, it's not that it can do either, but if it's a type of thing that can't get through the cells.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And you block the tight junctions, then it can't get through it at all. If it can get through the cells, then the tight junctions don't help, because it will be able to go through the cellular route. And that's why there are certain compounds that can get through your skin, because they can enter the cells and they go through the cellular route instead. Yeah, that's all I wanted to say about that one. Those are three intercellular junctions. Oh, it looks like we're done with this chapter, because just like the previous chapter, that final table is really just a synopsis. We've already talked about all that, so it's good to study, but I'm not going to sit here and read it to you, or stand here and read it to you. Okay.